Tap into the passion and vision of well-known entertainment luminaries with Thinking Out Loud. Go on a journey with unfiltered access to today's media innovators. Hear their strategy for rising above the crowded landscape. Important lessons and valuable wisdom that only comes from real industry experience.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on the media entertainment technology industry. Today, I'm speaking with Kevin Beggs, Chairman of the Lionsgate Television Group and Chief Content Integration Officer. Kevin oversees development and production of all scripted and non-scripted programming, and he's a 22-year veteran of the company who was spearheaded the strategic expansion of Lionsgate's television production operations into one of the largest independent television businesses in the world. Additionally, Kevin also oversees the company's Lionsgate 360 efforts, the cross-collaborative approach to developing new content from iconic Lionsgate intellectual properties across all of its businesses. So, Kevin, that should give us a lot to talk about today.
Sure.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sitting down with us. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Our listeners come from a diverse spectrum of the industry, different roles and backgrounds and experience sets. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the business so that we all
Sure.
have a framework for the conversation we're going to have.
All right. Well, as mentioned, I'm overseeing Lionsgate Television, and there's a core television business that is scripted and non-scripted that we do on a daily basis. We kind of made our niche or made our bones, if you will, in the cable space when, apart from HBO, was a pretty new area for cable companies to do originals with things like Weeds and Mad Men, and also jumped early into the streaming fray. Again, a smaller company, a little more nimble than some of the larger competitors, and got into things like Orange is the New Black and working at Hulu. And now, of course, we're in business with all the platforms and broadcasts as well, which we hadn't done in the early days. So there's that core business, and then Lionsgate, the group, if you will, in which I have a role in facilitating and coordinating and working with some other parts of the business, includes our syndication company about 5 years ago, Lionsgate 360, which was really formalizing a bunch of initiatives that were just organically bubbling up between film and TV, and many of these entities that I just rattled off, in which important IP was being deployed in new ways beyond just its original use, whether it was TV or film or otherwise. We thought we should look at those things less haphazardly and turn that into an actual formalized group. We meet monthly. There's about 50 projects that fall into that. The criteria for falling into a Lionsgate 360 is it in exploitation or adaptation in at least two verticals? Is it a TV show and a video game? Is it a feature film and a potential Broadway show in the future, et cetera, et cetera? And if it is, it makes it into that group, which is comprised of creatives from all the different groups and just shepherding this through, including theme parks and live stage things that we do. So there's a bunch going on. And the great news is we're still small enough as a company that those groups can meet effectively and really have impact. And I think in this world of streaming and everything pivoting to streaming and IP continuing to be so incredibly valuable and even more so every day, having some organization around how that's looked at is a good idea. And it began, again, like many things, just with casual conversations, and we've turned it into kind of a formal thing. So back to our core TV business, I think we have 27 series going in scripted in Lionsgate TV, 4 or 5 in our non-scripted group.
Has there been an overarching strategy to determine what fits and what doesn't at any given point in time so that you're putting the pieces of the company together in a way?
Yeah, well, I think it's twofold. John is an amazing CEO, an amazing manager. And when he came into Lionsgate, and I'm one of the few people that was there, I preceded him. So I actually have some context of the before John and after. And it was as a roll-up, which was an IPO put together in Canada. Like many roll-ups, it was an amalgamation of a bunch of little companies put together. And there really wasn't anybody managing it. Was an animation company and a studio facilities in Vancouver and Lionsgate Films. And everybody was kind of just running their little piece. I was brought in specifically just to be this one-hour series person and take advantage of Canadian subsidies and how those work, which I had known a little bit about from doing some producing. And when John came in, it was yeah, you can't run all these businesses just in a vacuum. There's got to be a plan. He actually knew how to do all that. And honestly, for the first time, I met a bunch of people in the company I'd never known, just because John said every Wednesday we all get together and plot this out. That same meeting happens every Wednesday, and that same approach. And he's such an inquisitive and acquisitive guy in that, you know, when John smells and sees a trend, he wants to be in it. And so some of the things have been experimental. Let's get in something. Then if it's not panning out, let's get out. But I think over time, what's evolved and the most important of all those acquisitions in many ways in the last 10 years probably is the Starz piece. And the reason we came up with 360 was that we would say informally, without a full platform, because we only owned a piece of Epix, that we were kind of 270. We had a lot of things, film, television, all the different things that I mentioned, and had a part of a platform. And when the Starz transaction completed, just in the world of like log taglines, was like, hey, now we're 360. We actually have the full breadth of what the majors have. And I think over time, the story is being simplified down, and wisely so, to film and television and Starz. And those kind of are core businesses. And I think that's a simpler story than with 50 disparate things. Even though we have pieces connected to all of these things, they roll up into those three categories. And I just now, having been in a publicly traded company for a long time, simplicity in the narrative is really important. And we've seen this again and again with much larger companies when people can't follow what's happening and there's some wobbliness of like, I don't know what this is going to be. Some companies are really navigating that really expertly, and others are still in the middle of it. It doesn't matter who they are, but we can think about the biggies that are in transition right now. And the analysts are just looking for a path. Our story is very clear.
So now you've got these each individually strong and combined even stronger entities, and you've got the Lionsgate 360 effort focused on driving collaboration and integration. How much of that comes into play into what you're producing through television? Is it starting to impact the type of content that you're actually developing, or is it still that you're developing content and then trying to figure out what to do with it?
I mean, look, it's just an added arrow in the quiver. If you're a studio, as we are, with a lot of film titles and great movies consistently being made every year in this evolving streaming universe, the lines between film and TV become a little bit grayer, and people are open to remakes or adaptations or expansions, which would have been more difficult before. When you've got something like a movie we released and control called Blindspotting, which was an amazing movie from David Diggs and Rafael Casal, and we all fell in love with it and looked at that and said, there's a series in here. It's an amazing 2-hour experience, but there was many more stories to tell about a gentrifying Oakland and incarceration and the prison industrial complex. And what are the impacts on real people? We obviously spent a lot of time inside prison in Orange is the New Black. This is a little bit about the movie itself, but also where we're exploring is the outside, the parole system, and how are the people on the outside being impacted in a changing city like Oakland, which is so specific. So that is, we weren't trying to fulfill like, hey, we've got to find a show about X. It was, hey, there's some great stuff that we should be looking at internally. And now let's see what the market holds. And a lot of interest, but it made perfect sense for Starz. And they were the most aggressive and took the first meeting and in production, and it's going great. And we're super excited. So it isn't driving our development as much as enhancing it, which is more opportunities. There's plenty of things that just walk in the door, a fully realized, pitched package ready, or somebody flags an article and says there's something in this. And this platinum age and all the competition, any edge that you have is welcome.
How does the relationship between the studio and Starz work? Starz get a first look? Is there some sort of funnel that you've established there?
Well, look, we work incredibly closely. Over the last couple of years, it's really settled into kind of a groove in a great way. And Jeff and I are talking constantly. And as with any network, as a supplier, the more specificity you are given about what their needs are, the easier it is to find the right thing. So there's certain things that are just never going to be right for them. We have a great show in Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist on NBC, but it is very much a broadcast show, family show. It's not something we ever would have pitched to them or presented. It's just not a premium cable, premium streaming series. And we're thrilled with it. And it's rated highly on its first episode back on Tuesday this week for NBC. It's perfect for them. There is no formal arrangement outside of we have really good insights because we're in such frequent communication about what's working for them and the things they need. And with that in mind, we can bring them the right things. And of course, they're well aware of the things and the overall deals, like any integrated studio network kind of situation. They know the talent we have. If there's interest or there's conversations to be had, by virtue of osmosis, there's going to be more collaborations. I think it works in the best possible way. But as I said, blind spotting was something that many people were after, and Starz bid on it aggressively, and that registered with the creative team, and that's where the show wound up. But there's been plenty of others that have not gone necessarily that way, and it's all part of the process, and we're extremely focused on our partners and making sure wherever we wind up with a show, it's a place they want to be.
So you're well aware of your own business entities and your partners' needs, but talk to us a little bit more about the funnel and how does your organization start to develop the shows that you ultimately produce? You're looking at trends, you're keeping your finger on the pulse of culture, right? And what else is going on that's directing the choices that you're making?
As a boutique place, even though now we're getting a little bit bigger, it's never been, we got to have four dramas this year, a couple of comedies, and then we have some output deals. It's never been that. It has always been creatively driven. And particularly because in the earliest days, the places we were working, not broadcast, which we couldn't afford, we could not be in that deficit game at the broadcast level in the first, I don't know, 15, 16 years of the company's existence. It was just not a place where we were going to be. The things we were developing had to be noisy. They had to feel premium. And because those places, as cable was really expanding into originals, and then that segued into streaming, those were the shows they were going after. So it's been a real lucky, I would say, privilege for me, but also for the team, in which when we're sitting down to talk about development, of course, we have business guidelines in our mind, and you're not looking to make a whole bunch of shows that lose money. That's not, you know, then you're going to be out of business. But in general, we're really looking and are interested in things that people are passionate about and that they're not going to get made elsewhere, because they're maybe not commercial enough, ostensibly. But we have found that when we have a hit for any platform, usually they are passion projects, whether it's Weeds or Mad Men or whatever it might be. Those turn into financial successes because the platforms love them and need to keep them on. And the longer a show stays on, the more possible it can be profitable. That's really the game in television, is longevity in general. When people ask us and they sit down with us, agents, producers, writers, what are you looking for? We don't really have an answer. We're looking for something that we're going to get excited about and that you want to make.
We are living through an unprecedented time of peak TV, and in some ways unexpected, because everyone thought that it was topping out in the 2016-2017 timeframe, and here we are starting 2021 and it's still expanding. That puts so much pressure on so many different points of the business. How do you go about finding and curating content?
It is a fire hose of content. And just from a purely practical standpoint of just taking it all in, even putting aside our business hats for a moment, just as a consumer, right? There's just no way you can get to everything. And of course, I used to pride myself on having watched one episode of everything, at least one, so that I would know going into a room what that network's entire slate was, and then be knowledgeable, not just that I read about a log line in TV Guide. Hard to do now in worlds of hundreds of shows, and many so good. I have this list just keeps getting longer and longer of, I think it's going to just be like when I'm retired, I can finally watch all these shows from when I was actually working, which is an ironic twist. But I think, look, it requires a bunch of teamwork. You know, Scott Herbst and Jocelyn are in the scripted group and just killing it with fantastic shows. Zoe's included, Love Life, we're prepping First Ladies with Showtime. They've got a great team with them, and their stuff is coming in all kinds of ways, and everybody has to roll up their sleeves, because there's no way to get through the work by just saying, oh yeah, I'm sending it down the hall. Scott will read 15 scripts tonight. This is not happening. In a good way, and I think a very interesting democratic way, this is an opportunity for aspiring and up-and-coming executives who find something that they love to champion it, because it is no longer, well, there's not enough buyers. Just think back to Three Networks, and I remember celebrating when you'd get an offer on a script. That would be a massive win. The chances of getting a script made to a pilot are infinitesimally small, but just getting a script was a huge win. Today, it's a little like, well, you didn't get a series order out of that? Sheesh. Come back when you have something real. There's chances and opportunities both on the writing side for people to come up through the ranks immediately and wind up being showrunners in one or two seasons, which is remarkable. But also, I think across the executive spectrum, for people to find something and champion it, because there's so much work, nobody can get to everything, and you have a chance to really distinguish yourself. So I think it's an exciting time for everybody. Now, all the disruption, of course, is making everyone crazy, because are you in a place that you thought was so sacrosanct, a huge major? We can just fill in the blanks of any major we want to talk about, that those are jobs people would have for a long time. Those are the places now that are completely insecure, but that's an opportunity for, I think, mid-sized studios and indies and producers and people that are willing to be a little more entrepreneurial, because nothing's certain anymore.
So it's not just the proliferation of content we're seeing. We're also seeing an expansion and a multiplying of dimensions of the type of content that's being produced. We're spreading our diversity wings in a lot of ways. There's a much deeper and broader menu of content for consumers to choose from. What does that look like in Lionsgate? Is there an intentional effort to diversify and expand, or do you follow the creative winds and go where they take you?
Well, TV, different than movies. So I would defer to Joe and Nathan and Aaron and his team on what they're doing, because they are buyer and seller. Television, there's always a third-party buyer. So much of what we do is informed by, as we were talking about with Starz, what are the needs of the clients? And let's make sure that we get clarity on what they are looking for. It's all fine, and I agree with my previous statement that we're lucky to get to develop things that we're passionate about, that we find interesting. We also have to extrapolate that they're going to be interesting to a buyer. Now, generally, our tastes all, I think, run similarly, because the buyers that we're selling to are watching premium stuff, whether it's on their own platforms or elsewhere, and the kind of shows that people talk about forever, whether it's The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or whatever that large genre of auteur-driven television is. It's honestly what most people that are executives are interested in making. So you're not going to run too far afield if you're in that zone. And that's exciting, and more people want that. And that's why the bar keeps getting raised higher and higher, and so many interesting talents, motion picture actors and writers and directors, are doing television and motion picture and bringing their skill sets, which are extraordinary. Like when you think about some of the shows. So we have to think about our end user. In the case of Starz, they are the end user. So they're really thinking about what drive viewership and subscriber growth and retention. So everybody comes at it from a slightly different place. But I do think the common denominator, as cliche as it sounds, is creative excellence, because that is what translates into must have something. TV, motion picture, network, app. When there is something that's driving everything, it bubbles up and people talk about it, and everyone, whether it's Game of Thrones or Bridgerton this week or whatever it might be, that becomes the focal point of the conversation. And everyone wants to be the focal point of the conversation because it drives more engagement.
You mentioned the writers, directors, actors, more people doing more projects, spreading their wings, but there's also more competition for that talent.
Yes.
So what does that part of the business look like?
Well, it's the Wild West, but it's super exciting. Again, I think opportunity is just everywhere. I mean, go back to, I'm not sure how old you are, but I'll date myself in thinking about the late 70s and early 80s as television. And let's just take Tom Selleck as an actor, let's just say, who is doing Magnum, hottest TV actor for a couple of decades, busy doing 22 to 24 episodes of television every year. And Tom Selleck has never had, outside of Three Men and a Baby and a couple of opportunities, a movie career. That was the received wisdom of what it meant to be in television versus movies for 50 years, let's just say. I was just looking at the Reagan's documentary on Showtime, which if you haven't seen is really great. I'm only one episode in, but it showed the moment in which Reagan took the job to do the GE television hosting, and essentially, and maybe he was already out of the movies, was done in features forever. And that line was so strong. And now think about it. Look at all of these actors moving in and out of series and limiteds and huge movies and the Marvel Universe. And I mean, you name it, it's just fascinating. Anything is on the table now, which it never was before. Doing a television show is not going to be diminishing to your career. It may be enhancing it, or certainly it's not hurting it in any way. It used to be that when you would talk to one of the big premium networks, they'd go, we can get anybody. And they could, but nobody else could. And now I think almost every casting conversation, just speaking now about on-screen talent, is a possibility if the material is good. Before, the stuff I'm sure never would have ever been presented. I mean, that's just on-screen, but I think it just goes across the board. I mean, again, passion project, someone's been wanting to write or to direct or to perform in, or sees really great character dynamics and something that's going to really be challenging as movies in the biggest studios become a little more comic book focused. Where's that ordinary people? That's going to be a series today. It's not going to be a movie in general. And actors love that. I mean, that's where you earn awards. So I think it's exciting for everybody on all sides that these possibilities are endless right now.
Are we seeing a transformation in, at least in American television, where there seems to be a trend towards shorter runs, shorter seasons, limited series?
Yeah. You hear
actors talk a lot about, oh, it's really a 10-hour movie, and that type of storytelling. And is that a trend we should expect to continue?
Yeah, I see it continuing depending on the nature of what the show may be. If it's a limited or it's even a seasonal anthology, let's say like the American Horror Story franchise, you can engage talent for a season and they're not tied up in long-term television deals, which could be as long as 7 seasons, which means they might have to say no to some dream movie that they were hoping to get, and so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of that. It is like a long movie, depending on the schedule. And the streamers, who have a very different business model and viewing model than broadcasters, who are in the business of doling out shows week to week over 22 possible weeks, particularly on a hit, let's say This Is Us or any big sitcom that people are coming to, and it's just a different cadence. But there's more and more streamers coming into the mix, and generally, whether they've aired it weekly or in bursts or all at once, they're banking on the catch-up, if you will, which is the binge, which is, hey, I've got a 3-day weekend. I'm going to watch season one of The Flight Attendant this weekend, or whatever it might be. So it's just a completely different experience. So that, I think you're just going to see more and more of that. It really was the UK model for a bunch of other reasons, partially because the UK model was often one writer doing everything and not the US showrunner writing staff model in which there's multiple writers. And now some of those things are kind of blending and hybridizing, but I think the utility for the streamers is there's a few breakouts that go a long, long, long time, but they've said pretty publicly some of these things are going to be 2 or 3 seasons experiences, and that's kind of what we need.
It's interesting. I hear more and more showrunners talking about how shows have been created with a 3-season arc or a 5-season arc, and that was always the intention. And sort of calming fans who are upset when shows go away. It feels to me like this sort of in and out model is starting to drive more business decisions.
Yep. I think it, look, wearing my studio hat, I've heard that many and many a time. And of course, that's all true until the show is a massive hit and your platform partner says, you know, that 1 season that we had in mind for Big Little Lies, can you just keep it going? I think we always fall down on the side of caution about not limiting your optionality in success. You just don't know. That's the bottom line. You just don't know what's going to work, what isn't. I mean, a limited is what it is, but I never want to basically rule out a hit that might go forever and ever because you just don't know. And maybe you cycle all the cast out or things change. Anything's possible, but a hit changes everything. And everyone's calculus is if a hit's on, nobody wants it to end. Well, I'm a huge fan of The Crown, and I think there was collective depression when they announced that that was going to be the last season. And then later that changed and everyone's super happy. And I'm looking forward to another season. But I think the viewership is so strong that until we run out of Queen, keep this thing going.
Yeah. You've overseen some long-term hits. We've mentioned a couple of them. Mad Men was, I believe, 8 seasons. And Orange is the New Black is 7 seasons.
I think Mad Men was kind of technically like a 7 seasons with a 7A and 7B. Weeds was 8.
Okay.
Nashville was 6. Nurse Jackie, I think, was 6.
Nashville's a great example of, boy, the fan passion when that show came to an end. I remember the press on that, and people were just clamoring for that to continue.
It's a great soap. Nashville came to broadcast at a time, it was one of ABC's biggest catch-up shows, right, in terms of viewing 7, 14, 21, 28, 20, however many ways they monitor. But they weren't, of course, able at that time, able to monetize much more than the Live Plus 3. So it's all fine and good, but it's not getting you paid. I look at Nashville as a show that was kind of ahead of its time in the bingeability for and broadcast being able to monetize that. And also, of course, it's not a procedural. So it's not something that's eminently repeatable because once you've seen it, if you were in a hotel room and you randomly dropped into a Nashville rerun, it'd be very hard to figure out where you are compared to a standalone CSI or Law and Order, in which it's like you ordered your room service, I'll watch an episode of that, I know who killed the guy, and you can go to bed not wondering what you missed. It was somewhere in between, and as these things have been shifting, but it is a show that's had an amazing fan base and the kind of show that today probably would go into the ecosystem of one of those places as a combo between the streaming platform and the broadcaster.
Well, it's also a show that crossed over into some new space. They did some stage shows and took it on the on the road.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Do mini concerts.
Oh, yeah. We had a concert tour. So, yeah.
That's
a lot of fun
to the earlier integration model you were talking about. And I think it was sort of early in the day for that. This cross-platform opportunity is big. Lionsgate seems really well-positioned.
It's always been a priority. And I think, again, when you're not a volume operation with 100 shows or 60 shows, right, every one of them has to be a crown jewel. And you need to extract every ounce of engagement. And that's not just monetary, right? But it's social media, it's this and that. The Nashville concert tours that we put on were just really reactions to the fan. I mean, uniquely, that show, the musicians and the actors, everybody that was cast in that show was a musician or performer that could sing and legitimately do music without a double, if you will. That's rare. That group was really talented, and there was a lot of clamor for them to perform from the fans, and we took it around the world. I'd be surprised if anybody made one penny on those efforts, but they were great engagement tools in a time when the show was off the air or waiting for the next season. And one of the great hallmarks of the country music world is their fan engagement, much like their NASCAR sports counterpart, that everyone feels, and in Nashville, to an extent, it's true, that you might run into a giant country star at Whole Foods or wherever, and you might. And we really tried to deliver that in the show itself. That's a virtue of that genre of music. They're not cloistered away in a suite at the Chateau Marmont. They're real people like you and me, singing about real things and have families and friends and relationships. But I think that was the key to was being authentic to that audience and to the actual musicians that make that music. But that includes fan engagement because they're so good at that.
Kevin, you sit in such a fascinating position with a very unique view of a broad swath of the landscape. Yeah. What are your top of mind impressions right now of where the industry is and where it's going?
That's big. Well, it's never been more exciting. I mean, it's terrifying on the one hand because of the disruption that we talked about and what does that mean and where does it all lead and is the consolidation going to just result in even more and more job losses and that's terrible. creatively, I don't think there's ever been a more exciting time in the television business, but television is being redefined entirely. And as I mentioned, that line between features, long-form television, series television, there's just a lot of things that are being redefined or undefined. And that's where great creative opportunities are going to come. The voices that, for whatever reason, were not able to be heard or be platformed are being found and put forward. I think you see it in the breadth and the diversity of the kinds of shows and offerings and the use of the genres, which are all over the place and no longer just in a couple of, like, it's an hour, it's a half hour, it's a movie of the week. There's so many different things being made. I think that's fantastic. And I think it's bodes well for our business. It bodes well for consumers. It bodes well for global consumers and the ability to see content from anywhere and everywhere. And I think shows can be transformational and impactful and change the world. And some of these traditional distribution channels that are being broken down or expanded or reconstructed in a more available way, obviously the ability for streaming to see millions, tens of millions, billions of people in a way that even the biggest broadcaster could never do, is transformational. And it means these stories can go everywhere. That's great in general. I think there's some wreckage that comes along with it, but I think any business disruption is going to find that. The hallmark of it all needs to continue to be, I think, just the best content. And interestingly enough, I think that's happening more and more and more. With the breaking down of certain barriers, the best shows are going to win. And I don't mean just win financially, but they're going to be seen by the most people. That has been difficult to accomplish in the traditional model.
Earlier, you mentioned that opportunity is everywhere, and you've done an excellent job today illuminating a lot of those opportunities. Thank you so much for spending time with us. It's been fascinating, sure. And we really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I really appreciate these questions. They're so provocative. Now I have to rethink everything, because now I can't even tell if I've shed any light on anything, but you've got me thinking, so I know what I'm doing for the rest of the afternoon, so thank you.
Well, that's the purpose of thinking out loud. I really enjoyed it, and I always walk away with new food for thought as well. Hopefully our listeners have more questions running around in their heads and have learned some things as well.
Beautiful. All right. Thank you so much.